This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Professor Marjorie Cohn about the Military Commissions Act of 2006. As we get closer to this year's primary, Mark Crispin Miller revisits voting election fraud. All that and more on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Recently, our own Michael Smith hosted a forum entitled, If It's Not Fascism, What Is It? Among the speakers was Mark Crispin Miller, a professor at New York University. For this talk, Mark focused on electronic voting machine election fraud, the subject of his recent book, Fooled Again.
This is not Nazi Germany, okay? I think that we're in, not in the middle, but toward the culmination of a process of what Bertellus called fascistization, and it takes a while to do this. But I think we have to understand that it's really quite different from the Nazi system and from the fascist system in Italy too. Let me tell you a story about the recent passage of this grotesque torture bill in Congress. You may have noticed that very few Democrats really said anything in opposition to this. It was striking how quiet they were. With the exception, I guess, of Patrick Leahy, nobody really said anything. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal about this last week. And it said that the Democrats were quiet because they feared what they called a Max Cleland moment, which meant that what they had in mind was the 2002 election, the off-year election in Georgia, where Max Cleland was surprisingly defeated in his bid for re-election by an unknown chicken hawk from the right named Saxby Chambliss, who's now the senator from Georgia. Now, what strikes me as extraordinary about this is that about 2 weeks ago, little less, Bobby Kennedy Jr. came out with his second piece in Rolling Stone about the election. You may have seen the first piece, June 15th. This was really the first time a mainstream media organ with a big, big readership dealt with this issue. The new piece is quite shocking, and one of the things it includes is testimony on the record by an insider at the Diebold Corporation, which handles Georgia's elections, testimony to the effect that 6 weeks or so before the 2002 elections in Georgia, the president of Diebold's voting machine division came personally, you read this, right? Came personally to Georgia and supervised an elaborate operation by the Diebold employees. They illegally placed software patches on every machine in the state. And he told them, don't tell county personnel about this. The official reason he gave was the clocks aren't working. This will fix the clocks. Make them run on time, right?
Like the trains.
Exactly. But this guy knew it had nothing to do with the clocks. Okay? Now, this isn't like the Rodney King videotape, okay? But it's very, very suspicious, and it helps us to understand the result in Georgia, because what happened was that a very popular senator, you know, Cleland has one limb, right? He lost the other three in Vietnam. Very popular in Georgia, and he was way ahead of Saxby Chambliss in the polls. It was this big upset victory. Chambliss won, and the same thing happened in three other states that year. Colorado and New Hampshire and Minnesota, where I think it was assassination that got them the seat, right? That's Wellstone. But in the other three, in New Hampshire, Colorado, and Georgia, you had three upset victories, three come-from-behind victories by far-right wingers in states that use Diebold machinery. Some people have called it Diebold magic, okay? Now, what's amazing to me is that the Democrats in Congress feared a Max Cleland moment, as if there were a ferociously right-wing theocratic majority that doesn't exist. This is, I think, is unprecedented. This is one of the weirdest things I've ever heard of. The issue of election fraud is almost completely taboo. No one will talk about it. No one will talk about it. At the grassroots level, everyone talks about it. Black, white, it doesn't matter. Even Republicans. I've been all over the country talking about this. There is no problem connecting with people at the grassroots level on this issue. The Zogby did a poll in August which found that only 45% of the American people think that Bush-Cheney were legitimately reelected. But it's the establishment that won't discuss this issue. And by the establishment, I don't just mean both political parties. And I don't just mean both political parties and the corporate press, but even the progressive press, by and large, won't cover this issue. So, you know, what accounts for this? Very odd. I mean, the Democrats, you know, some of them are complicit, right? In places like rural Ohio or in Georgia, Democrats and Republicans are kind of interchangeable, you know, because it's just a racial thing. And Diebold and ESNS and these other companies have a lot of money and they buy people. In fact, in Georgia, where the voting system has literally been privatized. You know, Diebold does everything that civil servants ordinarily do, everything. You know, they print the ballots, they count them, all that stuff, they do it. They sign that agreement in secret that it was never reviewed by the state legislature. They sign the agreement with the Secretary of State in Georgia, Kathy Cox, who is a Democrat. So there are some Democrats who are Republicans. There are also some stealth Democrats, like Teresa Lepore. Do you remember her? She printed up the butterfly ballots in Florida. And everybody said, oh, no, she's a Democrat. There's no conspiracy here. She's a Democrat. Well, she became a Democrat in order to run for the head of the county board of supervisors. She's a Republican. See, but if for propaganda purposes, they can say she's a Democrat. And everybody says, OK, no conspiracy. Let's all go back to sleep. Now, some of the Democrats are complicit. Most of them are in denial. You know, and I think that here Nazi Germany is an appropriate analog, because a lot of social democrats and some communists were in denial about Hitler. And the line was, you know, well, it's not so bad. He just has to say that. We'll deal with it. It'll be okay. You may have read the book They Thought They Were Free, which came out in 1955. It's uncanny how relevant that is to now. I had an exchange with John Kerry a year ago, when my book came out, Fooled Again. I wanted to give him a copy. In my naivete, I thought, here's the evidence. okay? 60 pages of notes, it's all here, I proved it. And since then, several of the books have come out, and there's no question about it, they just stole it in 2004, right? So if I just, you know, I'm reputable, more or less, you know, if I could get media, we'll deal with this. The people have to gain control of the electoral system or it's not a democracy. So I met Kerry. I said, you were robbed. This was at a fundraiser in Chelsea. He said, I know. And then he started to complain about the fact that his fellow Democrats in Washington are in denial. He used that phrase. They're in denial on this. And he said, I was just arguing last week with Chris Dodd. I said, Chris, these machines, you can hack them, they're insecure, they're very dangerous. And he said, you know what? He got mad at me. He said, we looked into this, there's nothing to it. He said, he's in denial. They're all in denial. I need evidence. Do you have evidence? You know, so we chatted about this. I tried to get him to come out front on the issue, because he's got the, you know, right to do it. And he said, well, somebody should do that. I don't know if it could be me, because of the sour grapes factor. And I said, that is a problem. But if you study the evidence, you'll be able to say, in perfect confidence, that you didn't believe it, and now you've studied the evidence. And I was writing a speech for him, you know. So we parted on excellent terms, okay? He was going to read the book, he socked me on the arm. He really did do that. And he gave me a thumbs up. It was, you know, really chummy.
At least he didn't salute you.
No, he didn't salute me. I don't find anything very funny about John Kerry, okay? As you'll see, so I'm a little humorless on the subject. So my book tour started the next Tuesday. This was a Friday. And then the following Friday, I was on Democracy Now! And I told the story, because it wasn't off the record. You know, I'm not a reporter. So Amy's producers got all worked up and sent out a press release, and, you know, Kerry believes the race was, you can still get it online. And then within 3 hours, Kerry's office released a statement categorically denying we'd had the conversation. Now, the ostensible reason for this is he's gutless, he's afraid that media will hammer him. Oh, that's fine. That makes sense, only up to a point. Because if he really believed the election system was compromised, if he really believed that his victory was taken away, see? If he really believed it, he wouldn't care if people hammer him, would he? I mean, if you're in a building and it's burning down and you're surrounded by people on coke who are in a silly frame of mind, you know, they might giggle at you if you say the building's burning and we're all gonna die, but you're gonna say it anyway. I mean, it's an urgent situation. So I don't really believe that explains, fear of ridicule explains his silence, which continued until about 6 weeks ago. And he finally came out and said, now he does think it was stolen, you know. Reporting for duty, remember that? So he's vain and he's narcissistic like so many of these guys, and he's not, you know, by any sense progressive, not even remotely. But this goes, you know, this is, I don't think we can understand this as like skull and bones, or, you know, he's secretly trying to help Bush out. I had a conversation with Jerry Nadler, who's, you know, my congressman, is probably some of your progressive enough, on the House Judiciary Committee, right? On the Conyers Committee. Now bear that in mind. So I saw him on the train in November, it was a month later, and I said to him, what are you guys doing about trying to fix the electoral system? And he said, well, look, Bush won Ohio by what? 400,000 votes? So he would have won anyway. Now, Bush won Ohio by 118,000 votes. And the bizarre thing is that Nadler should know that because he's on the Conyers Committee. They wrote the Conyers Report, which was the first sustained study of election fraud in the 2004 election. I think that Nadler's unconscious handed him a rationale for not taking this thing seriously because it's too scary, you know? This isn't just the usual thing where one party screws another. Both parties have stolen elections forever. I mean, I'm from Chicago. Nobody has to tell me that Democrats steal elections. I know this very well. But what happened in 2004 was completely different. What happened in 2004 was different in scale because it was not close. I believe that it was at least 10 million votes that were erased, okay? Secondly, it was different in its technological sophistication, because these voting machines enable a single person to alter the results in a state however he may want to do it. You know, with under 60 seconds you can do this. So it doesn't take like thousands of people. So it's different in scale, it's different in sophistication, and above all, and this is the point I'll conclude on, it's different, it's ideologically different. See, your traditional class, your traditional partisan vote theft is, you know, not admirable or anything, but it's completely rational. It's based on wanting the spoils, wanting to keep them, wanting to get them, wanting power, wanting patronage, all that stuff. And I think over the years, the parties have come to terms with each other. They've divided up the territory and so on. That's rational. What I found in doing the research for this book was that a lot of the vote, the election theft, was driven by a real fierce loathing of American democracy and the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and the Enlightenment. You know, I mean, we on the left, tend to minimize the importance of theocratic fanaticism. We say, well, it's just, Bush is just using it. That's not true. This is a very bizarre establishment, okay? It's at odds with itself to some extent, but we have basically, to put it very simply, we have an alliance of Straussian imperialists, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and all the intellectuals around them, who believe in religious government, not out of piety, but out of pragmatism. Because Leo Strauss taught that religious government is likeliest to create a docile population. They are very powerful, but they have no constituency. They have no political muscle. They have tremendous clout and influence. And they're embedded in the military-industrial complex. Their allies in this struggle, and they're not just tools, they're allies, is the Christian right, so-called Christian right, the Christianist movement. Because if you read Esther Kaplan's book, With God on Their Side, for example, you find that Bush has handed over the executive branch to true believers. And it's having an effect on people's lives. It affects the way we fight AIDS. You know, it affects reproductive freedom and all that stuff. But the VA, the FDA, you know, EPA, these people who believe in the rapture, who have no problem with apocalypse, I'm not kidding, I'm not making this up, they have a lot of real power. And a lot of at the grassroots level especially, a lot of the election theft was driven by this, that they really think it's not just their patriotic duty, but their spiritual responsibility to take power, because what they want to do is drive the system toward the apocalypse, because they think he'll come back sooner if that happens. So there's a book by Stephanie Hendricks called Divine Destruction, which is about the administration's environmental policy, which is far more radical than anything British Petroleum wants. It has theological roots. And this is a big movement, you know, which comes as news to us because the press never talks about it. Now, I think that, you know, the Bob Woodward's new book and the Foley Gate scandal, I think these come from inside the establishment. I mean, I don't think ABC News, by the way, worked for months on an explosive expose about the voting machines. ABC News, they finally killed it. See? The lawyers at ABC said, kill it. They killed it. I know people who worked on it. But they're going nuts on the Foley thing, which is like not a story. You know? So basically, what I think is going to happen is this. I think that despite their, you know, astonishing unpopularity, Republicans are dead. They're dead as a party. They would be dead as a party if there were anything like a franchise out there. I think they're going to win anyway. I hope I'm wrong. But the use of electronic voting machines and computerized tabulators has increased enormously since 2004. 81% of our votes will either be cast or counted by computer, which is like having a secret vote count. Laws have been passed in places like Ohio and Florida that require photo IDs, that quadruple the price of recounts. I mean, they are disenfranchising laws. They are Jim Crow plus laws. And in places like Georgia, where there is no requirement for a photo ID, the state is demanding one anyway. Talk about law and disorder. You know, whatever they want to do, they'll do, because they want to steal the election. And all the stuff about terrorism and the impending war with Iran are all meant to provide cover for this. You see what I mean? It's not because they think people will vote for them out of fear. I think people are past the point of voting for this regime. You know, once authority loses its credibility, it never gets it back. It's as Jacques Ellul teaches us in his book Propaganda. You don't get it back. Maybe an uptick of 2 points, but when you're finished, you're finished. They're finished. But if they, you know, scream terrorism and do something like attack Iran, and then they win, trust me, the official line will be, well, the American people rally around the flag, they're scared, they, you know. If they don't win it outright, so if they lose it by 2-3 House seats, and I have this from somebody in the party, talk about perverse, the plan is going to be to start screaming about election fraud. And since the Democrats won't do that, it will not have been preempted by them as it should have been. Because the Democrats, since Bush came on the scene, they have not stolen elections. They just haven't. It hasn't happened. There's no evidence of it. They don't need to, you know. So I think that we're, you know, this kind of the concoction of this rationale for why they won serves a second and even more nefarious purpose, which is to create a fake consensus on behalf of a shift toward fascism. Because if they say, well, people, you know, they're scared, they believe, they trust Bush, that means, you know, more surveillance, or maybe more brazen surveillance, more torture. I wouldn't be surprised if they try something with the internet, which they don't like. That's why they're trying to, you know, gut net neutrality. They want, and they do want, even events like this to be impossible. I think that they would like, you know, not to have to beat people up, but they'll do that if it takes it. And in fact, on Election Day 2004, there was stuff in the South, especially at black colleges, that sound like the old jackboot days. That stuff went on. And I got 2 appendices in Fooled Again, 2 eyewitness accounts of what the Secret Service and the police did in a small town in Oregon during the campaign. The cops, you know, attacked the people with rubber bullets. It was completely unprovoked. It was harrowing, and it got no coverage at all. See? So basically, you know, the weird thing here is that the establishment, including much of the progressive press, is sort of up here on this. And everybody else kind of down here. There's really no political opposition in this country because it's a consumer culture. We don't have parties. We don't belong to fraternal organizations. So basically, my view is that because a lot of people in this country actually take their voting rights very seriously and cherish the belief or the illusion that they live in a democracy, and that is potentially a very powerful thing. So that when they hear that their suspicions about the election have a basis in fact, it does tend to radicalize them. Thank you.
That was Mark Crispin Miller, author of Fooled Again.
Thank you. We go now to hear an excerpt from a speech delivered by Professor Bertel Ullman on the same evening at the Brecht Forum. The title of the forum is, If It's Not Fascism, What Is It? Bertel Ullman is a professor of politics at the New York University and has written and edited over a dozen books, including Alienation, Marx's Conception of Man in Capitalist Society, Social and Sexual Revolution.
If it's not fascism, then what is it? Well, what is the importance in the label that we give it? In my view, it has a great deal of importance. For there are consequences which affect our propaganda, which affect the kind of analysis that we can make of the existing situation, and finally, which have serious implications for the kind of political strategy that we can and want to use. But before answering this important question, what label to give what is going on in America today, there are a couple of distinctions that need to be made. Every fascist is an authoritarian, but not every authoritarian is a fascist. Every fascist state does away with civil liberties and punishes dissent with imprisonment and sometimes with death, but not every state which acts in this way a fascist state. Every fascist state is totalitarian, but not every totalitarian state is fascist. Stalinist Russia, Stalin Soviet Union, for example. And finally, and most important, every fascist state is a dictatorship, but not every dictatorship is a fascist dictatorship. Indeed, most of the dictatorships of the last 100 years have not been fascist, have been run by military figures, often with the help of a junta of generals, whereas the two main fascist states that existed in the 20th century, Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, the dictators there were not military men, and they had to do certain things, take certain positions in order to win the support of the generals in those countries. This very, very important difference, which I'll try to elaborate on a little later. In short, I'm trying to suggest that there's some value, but also a great danger in trying to establish the character of the United States today and decide what kind of label to use in referring to it, by relying too much on making comparisons between what existed in Nazi Germany and Mussolini Italy and what exists today. One more distinction before I go into what I think fascism is. There is an important difference in thinking about fascism depending on whether we're talking about fascism in power or fascism on the road to power, that the conditions which are crucial for the rise of fascism bring out different features than the characteristics of fascist states once fascist parties once in power. We'll begin then with the main characteristics of fascism in power, and use the two countries, Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy, as our models. These are, of course, the countries which most people admit as being classic examples of fascism. The main characteristics of fascism in power are, first, the absolute rule of one man through an authoritarian party over everyone and everything else. Two, fascism has the support not only of the middle class, particularly the lower middle class and the farmers, what in Europe is called the peasants, but also, at least certainly very soon after they come to power, also of the large majority of the rest of the population. Three, there are no other power centers in a fascist society other than the the fascist party. No other economic, political, social, cultural, or even religious power centers which detract from the authority and the point of view of the ruling fascist party. Four, while the capitalist class don't control the fascist leader, as is sometimes suggested, I think, in bad Marxist works, of which there are a few, this is the class that benefits most from fascist rule in the security which fascism gives to the economic rule of the capitalist class and the unequal distribution. The rapid expansion of the arms industry and other preparations for war, which go on almost immediately when the fascists take power in a country, through the destruction, certainly terribly important, of independent trade unions and other organizations of the working class, and finally through an imperialist foreign policy and wars that greatly expand the capitalist opportunities for business and profit.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Welcome law professor Marjorie Cohn to Law and Disorder. Later this week, Marjorie will become president of the National Lawyers Guild. During this segment, we discuss the Military Commission Act of 2006 and the resulting demise of habeas corpus. You'll hear an occasional phone ring in the background, as this was taped during a fundraiser for Pacifica's WBAI.
We're very glad to have you on the show, Marjorie. We wanted to ask you, because we know that you're one of the people in the country that comments to a wide audience on the constitutional crisis that the Bush administration has put us in. We wanted to ask you specifically about the Military Commissions Act of 2006. Tell our audience where it comes from and what it does to us.
Well, it comes from George W. Bush via the Congress, who saluted and marched, or should I say goose-stepped, to his agenda of taking unprecedented power to the executive to not only wipe away habeas corpus for non-citizens, but also to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens and declare them unlawful enemy combatants.
What does it do to a U.S. citizen who is so declared as an unlawful enemy combatant?
Well, we don't know, actually, what it does, but there are a couple of Yale law professors who have written articles and blogs that agree with my analysis, which is that U.S. citizens can be indefinitely detained. And if you take the example of Jose Padilla, a U.S. citizen who was not captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan, he was arrested in Chicago in the United States, locked up an enemy combatant, and held indefinitely for 3.5 years, until on the eve of the government's due date for their brief in the Supreme Court challenging whether they could do that, they quickly charged him with a crime that had nothing to do with the United States or any dirty bomb or anything else. And so the Supreme Court has not squarely ruled on that issue, but I think that there is a good chance that that issue will come to them in the near future. If you take the provision of the Military Commissions Act and its Section 948A, and it says that anyone, a person, it doesn't say an alien, so that means it could apply to U.S. citizens as well, a person who has engaged in hostilities or who has purposefully and materially supported hostilities against the United States or its co-belligerents can be declared an unlawful enemy combatant. And if you take that provision together with an article that came out in New York Times about the results of a Freedom of Information Act request or lawsuit filed by the ACLU, they found that military officials were labeling anti-war protesters as potential terrorists. And also they talk about disruption of military recruiting. And if you put that together with this particular provision of the Military Commissions Act, and you also read the press release from Halliburton on January 24th, 2006, it's quite disturbing. In that press release, they say that their subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, secured a $385 million contract to build a temporary detention facility in the event of an emergency influx of immigrants into the U.S., or, and listen to this, to support the rapid development of new programs. And then put that in the context of what our government has done in times of national crisis and war, such as the internment of U.S. citizens of Japanese, Italian, and German descent during and after World War II, and it paints quite a disturbing picture.
Yeah, you're telling me. My wife tried to make a joke of it, saying, well, at least now we know we can get a roof over our heads and 3 square meals a day in our old age, because this is targeted not like previously at Asians and Arabs and Muslims. I think this is targeted right at American Movement for Progressive Social Change here. I think it's got a lot to worry about. I understand that those facilities that they're building are going to be fully staffed, maybe not entertaining anybody yet, but they're going to be up and running and ready to do that. And I think that's just a time bomb ticking right in the middle of every American who thinks that we've got some democratic rights left here.
Marjorie, can you just explain a little more? Protesters, now, would a protester be under scrutiny because he or she is deemed providing support to a specific political cause that the government thinks is related to terrorism?
Well, we don't know. We certainly know that under the Patriot Act, they created a crime of domestic terrorism, which they've used to go after what they say are the number one domestic terrorist threat, and that is the environmental movement.
Right.
judging from what they've done there and judging from the incredible scrutiny and records they've kept on anti-war protests, I don't know what they're going to do. This New York Times article talks about a database that the military is maintaining called Talon, which has information about more than 1,500 so-called suspicious incidents around the country. And they're talking about anti-war protests, peaceful protests, protests on military bases. I can see them saying, and of course, I think that any court that wanted to follow the law would rule it unconstitutional, but saying that anyone who peacefully committed civil disobedience and tried to interfere with military recruiting to keep our soldiers from going to kill and be killed in the illegal war in Iraq were actually providing some kind of material support to the enemy and declaring them an unlawful enemy combatant.
Let's get back to some of the other provisions in the Military Commission Act of 2006, which both the Democrats and the Republicans got past us just a few weeks ago. I understand that it allows for torture, hearsay evidence, and wipes out for non-citizens the right of habeas corpus. Could you tell our listeners something about that, Marjorie Cohn?
Well, although it doesn't specifically say we allow torture, it gives Bush and his officials immunity from any prosecution for war crimes, and torture is a war crime under our U.S. War Crimes Act, for any past torture. The other thing that it does is it prevents anyone who claims that he or she has been tortured from going into court and saying that they've been tortured under the Geneva Convention, that they've been tortured in violation of the Geneva Convention. So even though Bush says we don't allow torture and the Act says that torture is not allowed, the way it's structured is very insidious, and it cuts off anyone's right to go into court and say, well, I was tortured in violation of the Geneva Conventions.
We're speaking with Marjorie Cohn, the incoming president of the National Lawyers Guild. Tell us some more about the provisions of this extremely scary bill that Congress just passed, the Military Commissions Act of 2006.
Alberto Gonzalez, who was then White House counsel, wrote a memo to President Bush saying that the Geneva Conventions were out of date. They were quaint and obsolete. And by the way, I've been researching for a book that I'm writing about what the Nazis did, and believe it or not, the lawyers who were supporting what the Nazis did, their legal eagles, their hired guns, said exactly the same thing. Hmm. They used the words quaint and obsolete to refer to the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. Now, it might just be a coincidence. Maybe Alberto Gonzalez had no idea that the Nazis used those words. But I found that very striking.
Yeah, I knew that. I knew they used those words. And there's nothing more quaint by their definition and obsolete than habeas corpus. That goes back to the Magna Carta of the year 1215. And they've abolished that for non-citizens. Tell us a little bit about habeas corpus, what it means and what it means to lose it.
Habeas corpus is called the Great Writ, and it was put in the Constitution very deliberately to protect the rights of people who want to go into court and say, I am being held unlawfully. You got the wrong guy. I should not be here. And once you take that away, that means that they can rot forever in jail. It's a very, very serious thing. And the Constitution says very clearly that Congress can only suspend habeas corpus in times of rebellion or invasion. And of course, we haven't been invaded by any country. On 9/11, we were attacked by 19 men, or rather, buildings were attacked by 19 men who hijacked planes. 15 of them came from Saudi Arabia. There's no rebellion going on. So my feeling is that if the Supreme Court remains in its present form, it will strike down that provision as unconstitutional.
Setting up military courts, these are not courts that have existed before. They're set up by the executive. There's such a thing known as command influence. Is there anything, do you think, constitutionally wrong with the executive also becoming the judiciary?
Well, there is certainly something wrong because the founding fathers put three different branches, co-equal branches of government, into the Constitution, specifically so there would be a separation of powers. And if you read the Federalist Papers, you will see that the founders were very, very worried that the executive might become all-powerful. They were worried very much about what Bush is now doing. And so what Bush has done is to set up these military commissions, and the Congress has approved them, to charge, try, convict, and execute non-citizens while being denied basic due process rights. The government can use hearsay.
Explain what hearsay evidence is for our listeners.
Hearsay is when someone makes a statement out of court and they bring it into court to use it to convict someone.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that the jury is not able to see the person who's making the statement, to watch their body language, to assess their credibility, to determine whether or not they're lying.
So it's not reliable.
It's not reliable, and that's why our federal rules of evidence prohibit hearsay. Also, it allows government to convict someone by the use of evidence obtained by coercion. Also, to deny the defendant the right to see some of the evidence against him. So if they say, oh, it's classified, or they can give him a summary of the evidence. And of course, this is unacceptable, because before you are convicted of a crime and even receive the death penalty, you should be able to see all the evidence against you. That's what the Constitution says, to be able to confront and cross-examine those witnesses against you and to try to convince the judge or the jury that, in fact, you are innocent. It allows a conviction and even an execution based upon hearsay evidence, coerced evidence, in a proceeding where the accused is convicted based on secret evidence. It's a kangaroo court. It's not what this country should be about.
We're talking to attorney and professor Marjorie Cohn, the incoming president of the National Lawyers Guild. We're talking about the Military Commissions Act of 2000, which has recently passed. Marjorie, where is this coming from? Why is it that in the last several years since 9/11, there's just been this torrent of unconstitutional legislation and practice that's come down? What is the purpose of this?
Well, I think the purpose of this is to suppress any dissent to the Bush administration's policies. And it started with the Patriot Act, and it has gone steadily in that direction. The latest example is this Military Commissions Act, although something that's very interesting. The media was extensively reporting that about 2 weeks ago, which was the week after Congress passed this Military Commissions Act, that Bush was going to very ceremoniously sign it and talk about how he was fighting terrorism, even though it has nothing to do with terrorism at all. And you'll notice we haven't seen anything about Bush signing it. Of course, the Foley sex scandal erupted, and I think Karl Rove is busy trying to put his finger in the dike and stem the damage. Some people are speculating that there might be some aircraft carriers headed for Iran, although I certainly hope that's not the case. And Bush has tried to change the subject with this recent nuclear test by North Korea. Although, of course, if I were North Korea and I was put in the axis of evil by Bush, and I saw what happened to another member of the axis of evil, that is Iraq, and what might soon happen to another, the third member of the axis of evil, Iran, I'd probably be trying to defend myself as well. Not that I'm happy that they are doing that. So I think it's very interesting that Bush has not signed this act yet. We'll wait and see what happens.
Well,
that gives us
time to keep agitating against it like we're doing now.
Right.
Here on WBAI, it's 99.5 FM Community Radio. We're in the middle of our fun pitch, We're Law and Disorder. We're talking with incoming National Lawyers Guild President Marjorie Cohn, and we're trying to raise some money here. And Marjorie, thanks very much for continuing to be our guest.
Marjorie, you've written a lot and are published a lot on these issues, threats to our civil liberties, to our democracy. And on Law and Disorder, we'd like to sort of give words of hope, words of action for listeners. What do you think are the most important things that people can be doing now to speak out against this?
I think that it is, while I don't think that the Democrats have showed much backbone at all in standing up to Bush, I think that at a minimum, we have to make sure that that the Democrats become the majority once again in Congress. And so I think that right now, in the next few weeks before the election, it's very important for people to work for Democratic candidates in both the House and the Senate. If Democrats take over the House of Representatives, then John Conyers will become the head of the House Judiciary Committee, and he has pledged to initiate impeachment proceedings. And as you know, the National Lawyers Guild has called for the impeachment of Bush and Cheney for high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, they haven't lied about sex that we know of, and of course that's a very serious high crime and misdemeanor, as we saw during the Clinton impeachment, but they certainly have lied about taking us into an illegal war and getting almost 3,000 of our men and women killed, and now the number, the official number coming out of Iraqi civilians is 655,000 have been killed. So I think it's very important to not just get the Democrats elected, but then push them to do the right thing, which is to hold the Bush administration's feet to the fire, hold hearings, subpoena documents, find out what they've been doing with their illegal wiretap program and the other illegal secret programs that they've been sponsoring. And I think most importantly, the way that our involvement in Iraq is going to end, which is the way that the Vietnam War ended, was for Congress to cut off the funding. And so I think pressuring representatives is very, very important, getting them elected and pressuring them. Beyond that, it's speaking out like you're doing right now, like I'm doing right now, writing letters to the editor, op-eds, organizing demonstrations, exercising our constitutional rights of freedom of speech and association and freedom of press. Because remember what Thomas Jefferson said. He said, dissent is the highest form of patriotism.
Right.
Yeah, I think the Bush administration has forgotten about that.
I wanted to remind our listening audience that this is Law and Disorder. I'm here with Heidi Boghossian, who's the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. I'm Michael Smith, attorney here in New York, also a member of the Lawyers Guild. And we have Marjorie Cohn, the incoming president of the Guild, on the phone. We've been talking about the constitutional crisis in this country. What's your take on the Lynn Stewart case? Why do you think she was prosecuted, and what do you think's at stake?
I think that Lynn Stewart was prosecuted because of the Bush administration's hyping the fear in this country after the 9/11 attacks. If this were pre-9/11 and the Bush administration was not hyping that fear and scaring people to death, she never would have been prosecuted for violating special administrative measures that she signed when she went into the prison. At the most, she would have been denied any more access to that prison, but she wouldn't have been charged with federal crimes. She never did anything to aid terrorism. She is not a terrorist. She does not agree with terrorism. She's made that very, very clear. And yet, what the Bush administration is doing with the case of Lynn Stewart is providing an example of what happens when lawyers zealously represent their clients, and that is that they become vulnerable to being charged with crimes by the government and juries who are terrified because of the Bush administration's hyping of fear will convict them. In fact, I think it was John Adams who was proudest of his representation of a British soldier. And, of course, the Brits were the enemy in those days. But when a criminal defense attorney is doing his or her constitutional duty, which is to represent his or her client zealously and to the best way he or she possibly can, leaving no stone unturned, they should not be called terrorists and charged with criminal offenses. And this was incredible overkill by the Bush administration, and I certainly hope that the judge will show some mercy and understand that Lynn Stewart is a top-notch criminal defense attorney. She's not a terrorist. She never intended or aided any terrorism, and she is a very, very important member of the community and of the legal community, and will show some mercy.
Marjorie, do you think, though, that the government has succeeded in intimidating lawyers from taking on unpopular clients?
You know, I think that probably has been the case. I can't give you examples, but I know that there is so much fear in every aspect of this society that when people speak out, they're so worried. They're worried that their phones are being tapped. They're worried that their calls are being traced.
And attorneys representing clients who now have good reason to suspect that their phones are being tapped and their email communications monitored.
Yes, because that's what they did, they eavesdropped on Lynn Stewart's conversations with her client. She never said anything about terrorism. She just actually provided the opportunity for her client to speak to the press. And that was not a crime. That was a violation of a special administrative measure in the prison.
What they did was they bootstrapped that act into a crime by saying that she conspired to aid and abet terrorism. How? By providing her client to the terrorists by issuing the press release.
But increasingly we're seeing the use of conspiracy charges with the green activists and animal rights activists and anyone the government wants to call terrorist. All they have to do is slap a few conspiracy charges on.
Yeah, it's like a thought crime.
Conspiracy is a very, very easy crime to prove because if you're even associated with someone, you don't even have to know what they're doing. You don't even have to know what act they're doing. It's a very, very broad net.
Thank you. We want to thank you, Marjorie Cohn,
thank
the incoming president of the National Lawyers Guild. A hearty congratulations even before you've stepped up to the plate. And we thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure, Michael and Heidi. Keep up the great work.
Bye. We're delighted to welcome our new affiliate, KWMD, in Alaska. Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there, you can ask questions, you can email us. We want to hear from you. Yeah. All right, all right, all right.
hanging way, way down. It's all right, all right, all right. Bring it way, 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 way down, all down. It's all right, all right, all right. Wait a minute. Think I'll understand all. I'll understand it's alright. It's alright. Yeah, that a little way to talk to me, oh baby. Hey. Somebody might not believe me. It's alright. Feel like you wanna dance. It's alright. Feel like you wanna move.